Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Iran's assistance has been pivotal to the growing strength of the Palestinian resistance against the Zionist colonial occupation. And in the first part of today's programme, we'll be looking at the Islamic Republic of Iran's role in supporting the liberation of Palestine. In the second half of the show, we'll be examining how Palestine resistance factions themselves view Iran's role in their struggle for freedom. But first, we've got this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra setting out the extent to which Iran supports Palestinian liberation.
As the Palestinian resistance factions increasingly come together and take the fight to the Zionist entity, what kind of support are they getting from outside? Even its worst enemies recognise that since its establishment in 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran has become a leading patron of the Palestinian cause. Those are the words of the Zionist front group United Against Nuclear Iran. They are quite correct. How has Iran supported the legitimate resistance of the Palestinians? Earlier this year, tens of thousands of Iranians have taken part in the annual Quds Day rallies in the capital, Tehran, in a major show of support for Palestine. Similar marches and events happen in more than 900 cities and villages nationwide, according to officials. Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, who was the keynote speaker of the event in Tehran, told the gathering crowd that Iran's first supreme leader, Ruhollah Khomeini, established Quds Day shortly after the 1979 revolution to let the world know that Palestine was not alone. He said the current supreme leader, Ali Husseini Khamenei, subsequently established the Quds Force, the overseas arm of IRGC, to expand the Islamic revolution in other Islamic countries with the aim of pressuring the Zionist regime, and in the near future, the regime's elimination from the world's political geography. Even the Jerusalem Post recognizes the strategy being adopted by Iran of unifying the resistance, a strategy which is visibly now in operation. In the Unity Intifada of May 2021, it was revealed on the Lebanese news service Al-Manar that a joint operation room was established in Beirut in response to the Zionist attacks on Gaza. It involved officers from Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The commander of IRGC's Al-Quds Force, General Ismail Qani, visited Lebanon twice to attend the meetings. The Palestinian factions were provided with data about the movement of the Israeli occupation military, which frustrated the enemy's plot to ambush the Palestinian fighters near the Gaza border. According to the editor-in-chief of the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar, Ibrahim Al-Amin said, "Had Israel expanded its aggression, the entire axes of resistance would have confronted it." Amongst the other support from Iran is funding, weapons and training. In 2020, Al Jazeera broadcast revelations from Hamas about the weapons being supplied by Iran. The programme What Is Hidden Is Greater showed members of Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, collecting Iranian Fajr missiles and Hornet anti-tank shells. The Islamic Republic of Iran stands fully behind the Palestinian factions and is central to the wider axis of resistance.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Sami Ramadani. Sami is an Iraqi-born lecturer in sociology, and he writes on Iraq and current affairs of the Middle East. He's also a member of the steering committee of the Stop the War Coalition. Sami was a political exile from Saddam's regime, but he actively opposed the US-led sanctions on Iraq and campaigned against the invasion and occupation of his homeland. Welcome to the show. David, what can you tell us about United Against Nuclear Iran? And should we listen to their assessment, do you think?
Well, United Against Nuclear Iran is one of the most pro-Israel think tanks in the US. Mm. I mean, it really should be registered as a foreign agent of the Zionist entity, but it's not. But it has on its board people who used to be the director of Mossad, and it's really quite kind of out there as a kind of extreme supporter of Israel. But nevertheless, they recognise that the role which Iran plays. And so, you know, it's interesting that even an organisation as ultra-Zionist as that is able to say something about how Iran relates to Palestinian liberation, and it's an accurate statement. Mm. And even though this is a hyper-Zionist organisation.
Well, Sami, I mean, tell us about the history of Iranian support for the Palestinians.
I think 1979 obviously is the critical year, because that's when the Iranian Revolution overthrew the Shah's regime. And the Shah's regime was a cornerstone of Israeli Zionist presence in the area. The Iranian regime under the Shah acted as Israel's main ally in the region. And the Iranian Revolution dealt a heavy blow to Zionist presence in the area, and put a halt, at least, to a lot of the aggressive policies that the Zionist leaders were planning in the region.
What does this daily coordination in Beirut tell us about the relations with the resistance and Hezbollah?
Well, I mean, the fact that they've got this daily war room where they're actually planning joint operations, not just between the Islamic Republic and the Palestinian factions, all of the factions, but also with Hezbollah. It shows that they actually conceive of the Axis of Resistance as being a functioning organisational body. And, of course, it encompasses also groups in Iraq and in Yemen and in Syria. But it does show that there's an actual functioning Axis of Resistance, which effectively has its own governance structures. And that's an indication of the unity that there is now against the Zionist entity, and the fact that it's looking increasingly difficult for Israel to continue its activities.
Mm. I mean, Sami, I mean, can you explain what this term Axis of Resistance means?
It obviously evolved after the Iranian Revolution of 79. And basically it includes the various Palestinian resistance groups, Hezbollah in Lebanon. And later, obviously, as states, this term became to include Syria, and some Iraqi organizations, as well as, of course, Iran. And nowadays, you can even include the resistance of the Yemeni people against Saudi aggression.
I mean, and the resistance, of course, is seemingly, from the outside, becoming more effective than I think it's been in the past. I mean, would you agree with that, Sami?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there were some decisive moments, especially within the context of the two arenas, and a third one, I'll explain that as well. The first is the presence of Hezbollah in Lebanon, which actually defeated the Israeli occupation forces and defeated new aggressions on southern Lebanon and on Beirut and Lebanon in general by the Israeli forces. So that these events, these great military victories, became axiomatic or extremely important to the development of resistance against Israeli occupations and aggressions. And the second arena is Gaza, of course, and Palestine in general. Or if you like, this is the first one because it preceded the resistance in Lebanon. And the heroic, incredible resistance of the people of Gaza, for example, Palestinian people in Gaza, is incredible because Gaza is just one big prison occupied by Israel, surrounded sea, land, and air by Israeli occupation, is quite a remarkable form of resistance. Since 2011, there also evolved resistance within Syria against the terrorist organizations that attempted to divide and destroy Syria completely.
Let me just ask David a question, if I can, before we go to the next clip that we want to show you. I mean, I just wanted to ask you, David, I mean, what do you say to the people who've been claiming that Iran and Syria, for that matter, actually, are not really anti-imperialist countries at all?
Well, there's no purity in struggle. I mean, in reality, there is the imperial power, which is the US and its allies, and the UK and Israel, and there is the opposition to that. And the opposition to that is the anti-imperialist cause. And people say, well, they're not left-wing enough. They're not like Venezuela or Cuba. That's not anti-imperialism. But, of course, anti-imperialism has got nothing at all to do with the question of neoliberalism. It's a question of whether you actively are in supporting the resistance. And if you ask the resistance what they think, they say, yes, Iran is our ally.
Well, we'll just pause there for a moment, because we've got a report now about how the resistance in Palestine actually views Iran.
The commitment of the Islamic Republic to the liberation of Palestine is not metaphorical or emotional. It is a clear material relationship that can be traced through the statements of both friends and enemies. Those who question Iran's selfless support for Palestine need only review the statements made by the resistance factions themselves for clarity. The generous support the Islamic Republic has given Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad is well known. What is less well known is the support it has given to both Fatah and the PFLP. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, founded in 1967 by George Habash, has struggled long and hard for liberation from Zionist colonialism and achieved some considerable victories. Just 21 years ago, the PFLP carried out the assassination of the highest-ranking Israeli minister by any Palestinian group throughout the struggle. The Israeli Minister of Tourism, Rehavim Zeevi, was tracked to a hotel in occupied Al-Quds and liquidated by PFLP operatives. The action was taken in response to the Israeli murder of PFLP leader Abu Ali Mustafa. As Talal Naji, the PFLP's Secretary General, revealed in an interview, Iran supplied all the Palestinian resistant factions, including Fatah, with weapons transported by ship. Naji claimed that while many know about the famous Karin A ship, which was stopped by the Israeli from transporting weapons to Fatah, most do not know about the 9 other ships that got through. He then asserts that in order for the factions in Gaza to develop their own means of resistance, the guidance of the late Qasem Soleimani was vital in developing the methods through which the factions produce their own rockets. Prior to this taking place, Naji makes clear how limited the capabilities were. The training to develop these means would take place in the Islamic Republic, Syria or Lebanon under the supervision of Qasem Soleimani. Talal Naji states it was Soleimani who personally oversaw the delivery of the Kornet rocket, a Russian anti-tank missile, to Gaza. These rockets allowed the resistance to shock the Israelis by destroying their Merkavat tanks in 2009. Talal Naji later added, were it not for the principled support and positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the victories of the axis of resistance in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq and Yemen would not have happened today. Israel has consistently accused the Islamic Republic of supporting Palestinian resistance factions as if it was a bad thing, guilty as charged. Despite relentless conspiracy against it, the axis of resistance still stands.
Sami, you touched on this a little bit in your previous answer, but I just wondered if you could give us a brief outline of the different Palestinian factions that were mentioned in that clip we've just watched.
I mean, the two, if you like, historically most important organizations that appeared on the scene in terms of organized resistance, the very first one was Fatah, which was, it started military operations in 1965. First January 1965, in fact. So Fatah became the largest resistance organization, followed closely later on by the establishment of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And there are other organizations, obviously, but the, if you like, the most important addition to these groups was the emergence of Hamas in the early 80s. As a military and political force. And Hamas gradually grew and grew and became much bigger. And Gaza became the center of activity and organization, and its leadership emerged, or rather consolidated their presence in Gaza. So if you like, these are the three most important organizations representing various political trends within the Palestinian people, but with a common objective of liberation of Palestine and of continuing resistance. Sometimes there are tactical differences about forms of resistance, but there is broad agreement, strategic agreement about the liberation of Palestine and resistance to Zionist occupation and aggression. And these organizations had various levels of relations, whether with Hezbollah or with Iran or even with Syria, because Syria for few decades, actually, Damascus was a major center for supporting Palestinian resistance. And although it became obviously the Syrian state became heavily involved to protect Syria itself. And let us not forget that Syrian lands are also occupied by Israel, the Golan Heights, very strategic, very important area of Syria. So you have an emergence of commonality of interest against Israeli aggression and occupation, and Iran became a major ally of that scene.
Yeah. David, I wonder whether you could say, or indeed, what you make of the Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Tal al-Naji, what he said in that segment. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's perfectly clear, isn't it, that that all of the factions are being supported by the Iranians. It's not just the one which is perceived to be closest to them, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but all of the factions. And it's also clear that there's much more in the way of support going on than isn't publicly known about. So sometimes we see ships are seized or materials are stopped. But clearly there's lots of other material which is getting through, yes, by sea, but also by land as well. So there's clearly a massive operation going on there, and the Israelis have been a bit surprised and shocked by that sometimes, and especially in the Unity Intifada of last May, where they were preparing for a ground operation, and ground invasion of Gaza, and they discovered they couldn't do it, and they pulled back, and there was a ceasefire. So there's a real balance going on here, which people perhaps don't realise.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, Sami, it's not well known that Iran also armed Fatah, is it? And what do you think that says about the wider policy of the Islamic Republic towards Palestine?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, because it dates back to 1979, and in 79, Fatah by far was the largest Palestinian resistance organisation, and their leader went to Tehran straight away. And from there on, they built very, very close relations between Fatah and Iran. And Iran, as soon as they could, started supporting materially Fatah. And later on, the PFLP, and later on, Hamas, and later on, Islamic Jihad, which is a much smaller organization within Gaza. But in recent years, it has become much stronger force, and perhaps ideologically very close to Iran as well, more closer than others on other issues to do with the religion, to do with the perspectives about resistance and revolution and so on. But broadly speaking, all these organizations, and centrally Fatah initially, was quite an important link between the Palestinian people's struggle and Iran, as expressed by the then Fatah leaders themselves and the Iranian leaders too. So it's a broad scene, and it indicates as well that Iran has a certain political, ideological position on Palestine, yeah, as well as a religious perspective and so on. But in terms of the broad political approach, they regard Palestine as central to the struggle of the peoples of the region, as well as the Iranian people themselves, that the arena of Palestine is vital for the struggle of the Iranian people themselves and their struggle for independence. Remember, I mean, Iran is such a massive strategic state in the whole region, and this state became independent of U.S. domination in the region. And U.S. dominance.
Let me just move on to David now, because I just want to get David's thoughts about a recent interview, the leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, commented that Hamas receives a lion's share of Iran's support to Palestinians. I mean, I wonder how you think that might confound expectations.
Well, as Sammy was saying, I mean, both Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are later on the scene than the previous organisations, more secular organisations. And Palestinian Islamic Jihad is much smaller. But it's perceived as being much closer to the Islamic Republic, and therefore people, I think, imagine that they get almost all of the aid that the Iranians get. But no, on the contrary, it's Hamas which gets the bulk of the aid because it's the largest military force. But what we see, I think, increasingly, is a kind of blurring of the lines between these different factions. And with the recent attacks that there have been and the recent activities that have been in the West Bank, especially the appearance of the Lion's Den and various other Palestinian resistance groups, you see even groups, fighters from Fatah involved in the Lion's Den, along with fighters from Palestinian Islamic Jihad or from Hamas. So there's a real sense in which those lines of difference are blurring.
Mm. Very briefly, Sammy, because we're almost out of time, I just wonder whether you could say what price you think the Islamic Republic pays for its steadfast support for the resistance.
I think it's a massive price, really, to be accurate about what's going on. The Iranian state has been subjected to massive opposition from imperialism led by the United States and regionally by Israel and some of the Arab regimes as well. So one of the main reasons why the United States and Israel are so opposed to Iran and try to punish Iran is the stance on Palestine. So part of one of the most important reasons for the sanctions, for example, is support for Palestine. And by extension as well, support for Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is an anti-Israeli force, support for Syria, because Syria's lands are occupied by Israel and Israel supports terrorism in Syria. Also within an Iraqi context, Israel and the terrorist groups are extremely active within Iraq. They use Iraqi Kurdistan as a base against Iran. So on many fronts, the Iran is paying a heavy price, but they are proud of it at the same time. Politically, they say this is our politics, this is our ideology, this is how we want to conduct.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, Sammy, because we're right out of time. I'm really sorry. We could go on for a lot longer, but I'd like to thank our guests today, Sammy Ramadani, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's medical blockade of Gaza has been described as one that gravely breaches residents' rights to healthcare in Gaza and outside. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, Mahdi Amer, 35, lost his father at the beginning of the new year. Ibrahim Amer was 65. He had a heart attack. But due to the Zionist regime's blockade of Gaza, the emergency equipment he needed and that could have saved him was simply not available in Gaza. Mahdi said, "My father suffered from a blockage in each of his four arteries, resulting in a sudden heart attack. because there was no interventional catheterization device that could save my father, he was referred for treatment. An attempt was made to have him transported to a West Bank hospital, but it came too late. With all the bureaucracy involved in getting an exit permit from the Zionist regime military and the time spent traveling, Ebrahim didn't make it in time. He returned to Gaza in a burial shroud. For over a year, according to Gaza's Ministry of Health, the Zionist regime has prevented medical diagnostic devices, critical equipment such as mobile and standard X-ray machines, as well as spare parts of such machines, from entering Gaza, along with a host of medicines and other medical equipment barred from entry. The Zionist regime's blockade has left Gaza's health sector dramatically undersupplied and in a constant state of crisis. This, in spite of clear international guidelines and rules under the Geneva Conventions and other international agreements that the right to healthcare must be preserved in times of war. Cancer patients are particularly vulnerable to the lack of access to X-ray machines. That ability to track the spread of cancer is crucial to combating the disease, and even if hard-to-obtain travel permits, travel costs are exorbitant, said Subhia Skeik, 55. Despite all of this, Skeik is hopeful that the health crisis will be resolved and we will have access to every possible course of treatment. Some private health centers do have X-ray or magnetic resonance imaging MRI machines. The one that at Gaza's main Ashifa hospital is often broken due to the inability to import spare parts, but the cost of using them is often prohibitive in Gaza, where the average daily wage is only $10. Khaled Asayat, 30, had an accident that led to serious fractures in his feet and back. "When I went to the hospital, their X-ray machine was out of order," he said. Asayat was able to pay $60 for a scan at a private health center, but now he needs an MRI. He said, "The hospital told me that hundreds of patients were waiting for their turn and my appointment is not for a month. Medical professionals are helpless. All of our hospital units are suffering due to the limited access to medical devices," Muhammad Abu Salmia, director of Ashifa Hospital, said, adding, "These are life-saving equipment for our patients, many of whom ultimately die because we cannot treat them properly." Abu Salmia lamented the lack of interventional radiology equipment that he needs and the insufficient worn-out equipment he is forced to work with. "We use a very old device for interventional radiology that we urgently need to replace. Patients have to be transferred to West Bank hospitals, but there are several cases where they have died from not receiving medical intervention quickly enough," he said. "There should be 6 X-ray machines at Ashifa Hospital. There are only 2, he said, adding, "We are often compelled to move a patient from the intensive care unit to a different floor, often while they are connected to oxygen, in order to take an X-ray. This is unhealthy." Compounding frustrations, health professionals say there is no reason for the Zionist regime to prevent these devices and spare parts for their repair from entering Gaza. Many are donations. Ebrahim Abbas, director of the Medical Imaging Unit at the Ministry of Health in Gaza, pointed out, citing the example of 14 devices blocked from entry in October 2021, all donated by the Palestinian Economic Council for Development and Reconstruction, PECDAR. "These imaging devices still sit in storage, awaiting permission to enter," Abbas said. Fazel al-Muzaini of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, said the Zionist regime had to honor its obligations under international law. The Oslo agreements and the resulting transfer of the tasks of providing health services to the Palestinian Authority do not exempt the Israeli occupation from its obligations to facilitating healthcare in the Palestinian territories. According to al-Muzaini, over 13,500 patients in Gaza are currently waiting to undergo surgery, major and minor. A number the health sector is simply too under-equipped to deal with. PCHR works alongside other human rights organizations to provide legal and logistical support for official Palestinian agencies to facilitate the supply of medical devices. Sometimes these efforts succeed, but not enough to mitigate the life-threatening restrictions the Zionist regime imposes on the Gaza Strip. Al-Muzaini said, "The primary responsibility for providing medical supplies to the residents of Gaza Strip rests with the Zionist regime occupation authorities."
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the destruction of Islam's holiest sites by the Saudi regime in a conversation with Dr. Irfan Al-Alawi. But first, this brief analysis.
How does one begin to understand the historical ignorance of the majority of Muslims regarding the destruction of the religious and historic heritage of Hejaz, the land of Prophet Muhammad, where the Holy Quran was revealed and Islam was established? How many people know that the contemporary kingdom of Saudi Arabia is built upon the ruins of Islam's holiest sites and their destruction at the hands of Wahhabi Takfiri armies led by Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, the founder and first king of Saudi Arabia, after his army's conquests of Mecca and Medina in the mid-1920s? Is it a coincidence that at the precise time when the British Empire is destroying the Ottoman Empire, American oil companies are beginning to exploit the massive crude oil reserves in eastern Arabia, and Western Zionists are salivating to establish a colonial Zionist settler state in Palestine, that at the same time, an army of illiterate Takfiri Wahhabi Bedouins conquers the heart of the Muslim world and pulverizes everything of religious and historical value and significance related to Prophet Muhammad, his pure family and companions, and the early history of Islam? How are we to understand the silence of so many Muslims when nearly 100 years later they witness the Najdi Bedouin Saudi conquerors of Hejaz turning Islam's heart and holiest cities into a concrete jungle filled with cheap imitations of Western high-rise hotels, the tower over the Holy Kaaba, and gaudy, ugly shopping malls dedicated to the gods of consumerism and gluttony? It's very likely that the incompetence and inability of many Muslim political leaders to create viable states and economies has made them completely dependent on the handouts of Saudi petrodollars for survival, and apparently has had a negative effect on their ability to learn contemporary history and use their tongues to protest the destruction of Islam's holiest sites, something that is happening right in front of their eyes. The moral impunity and legal immunity granted by the United States, Britain, and the Zionist-owned global media to the Saudi tribe is not limited to cases of killing, chopping up, and then dissolving the remains of a dissident journalist in acid, but apparently also extends to the systematic destruction of the history of Islam in Islam's two holiest cities of Mecca and Medina. How do we explain this savagery, this ignorance, this destruction, this silence, and this impunity?
Dr. Irfan Alalawi, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. I'm very glad we are able to have this conversation, Doctor. We had a recent interview with Dr. Ali Al-Ahmad, who talked about some of the crimes of the Ahl Saud as it related to the eastern provinces, the Shias, and other areas. And in that conversation, a very interesting issue came up, which I thought is very important that we follow up on and that we talk about, because it's an issue that really is hurting the soul of hundreds of millions of Muslims. And that's the issue of the destruction of the religious, cultural, and historic heritage of Hijaz. Hijaz being the region, of course, where Mecca and Medina are located, the heart of the Islamic world, the land of revelation, the place where Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the companions and the Ahlul Bayt all originate from and lived. And this is something that you have been, this issue of the destruction is something that you have been talking about for 3 decades. You've been commenting about it, you've been documenting it, and raising your voice about it. Basically, what we have is that when people go for Umrah and for Hajj, basically all the data is being shared or given by the Ahl Saud to the enemies of Islam, the United States, the Israelis. And this is put into the database. This is then the facial recognition is put into the database so that any place on earth that this person then goes after that, they are in the database of the Americans and the Israelis. Do I understand you correctly?
Absolutely. Before this, they used to have an iris scan at the airport. Uh-huh. If you come to the Matar and they would iris scan you, and they gave up that. Then they used to scan your fingerprint you. They gave up that. So came up with the new technology, which is, of course, to have a facial recognition. But at the same time, let me explain a bit further on this, if I may. Yes. We have the coronavirus, which is a pandemic. Okay, so they put this poison in the House of Saud. They listen, now you need to turn around and have an app put onto your phone. So those who visited the Grand Mosque, Mecca and Makarama and Medina and Munawra, they have to download an app. So to go Riyadh al-Jannah, to be able to pray in Riyadh al-Jannah, one could enter at any time and pray there and exit. Now you need to book on an app the time and date that you will visit Riyadh al-Jannah in Masjid Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam in Medina. Otherwise, you are not allowed to visit Riyadh al-Jannah. If you go to in Haram Sharif, when you do the circumvallation of the Mataf, you are supposed to performing Umrah. You need to have that booked in, and in the Hijr Ismail, which is the small arch next to the Kaaba,
yes,
you're not allowed to pray in there until you have booked a slot on the app to be able to pray there. So the idea here is they are trying to control the Muslims to be able to be wherever they visit in the holy mosques, what time they're visiting, who is visiting, and on their mobile as well, regardless if it's a Android phone or Apple phone.
Right.
If I may say so, another issue here is, which is a very interesting fact, according to Imam Malik, the Hijr Ismail, which is the arch, and it was a part of the Kaaba, which the Hashemites, when they ran out of money, they could not sort of build the Kaaba from there, although it's still considered to be part of the Kaaba, even though you pray inside it.
Right.
That, according to Imam Malik, is where Hajra, the wife of Ibrahim, exactly, alayhi salam, exactly, and Ismail is buried. Amongst the 70 Anbiya and the Prophet buried in the Mataf area. So the question here is, are the Sauds going to say, okay, well, let's really excavate everything and dig out the graves that we are circumambulating on and around? The Maqam, which is another fact, which before I forget, Maqam is a very, very important location of the son of Ibrahim alayhi salam, Ismail alayhi salam.
Exactly.
And the idea was they wanted to move this all together not very long ago, about 20 plus years ago. They said, well, you know, this is coming in the way of the Mataf or circumambulation, so let's just take it away. and remove it. This was a bad idea because they realized that people are coming here and praying two rakatain, two cycles of prayer near Maqam Ibrahim, just behind it. And they said, oh, this is bid'ah and shirk. So a great Sufi master, he brought this up, Sheikh Mutawalli al-Sharawi, who was a great muhaddis of the Quran. He was a student in Al-Umm al-Qura. When he found out about this, he said, this is not right. This cannot be possible. So he wrote to King Khalid at the time, and he gave his evidence there because they only had a couple of days left before this idea was to be implemented. And then when it was picked up by the king, he said, okay, let's have a meeting on this. When they discussed this, he said, listen, this was still there at the time of Umar ibn Khattab. Even when there was a flood in the around the area, then they moved it away, but they never dared to dismantle it or move it away. And because the Quran says this is the Masalla of Ibrahim, and this is the very rock that he stood on when it was elevated, when he was building and maintaining the Kaaba. And how can you remove something physically when it's mentioned in the Quran? Inna Safa wa Marwa min Sha'irillah. These are signs of Allah. You're walking from one side of the mountain to the other. And are you going to say, okay, well, demolish the Safa and Marwa mountains and say, okay, well, do the Umrah or Hajj without? It's impossible. But yes, they are intending to do this. And yes, they have already done it. The Marwa mountain is gone. It's disappeared. Only the Safa mountain is remained. So what is the Muslim going to wait for until they demolish the Kaaba? And we'll move on to that when we go further on.
Okay, doctor. So let me, we have a couple, about 10, 15 minutes left. So let's mention some other of the things that they have done. You mentioned the Blessed Father and Mother of the Prophet. You mentioned the fact that the house in which you had the revelation coming to the Prophet, the house of Hazrat Khadija, that was destroyed, and it even hurts to say it, but it turned into a public toilet, that area. We have, of course, all the areas related to Ahlul Bayt. We have Jannatul Baqi, both Mecca and Medina, all these. If you could, please give us a few more examples, and then I want to talk about, with your permission, a little bit about Hijaz itself, because you are emphasizing that we should call it Hijaz. Hijaz has its own history, has its own identity, has its own culture. Let's talk after that a little bit about Hijaz as well. So if you could, please give us now some more examples of what they've done to destroy this history in Hijaz.
Okay, let's talk about quite recent one, where in 1989, we realized that it was the house, or we located the house of Sayyidah Khadija, the wife of the Prophet, again, which I mentioned, they received the Quran. And we realized that it was from the Babel. When we go into the Sa'ir area towards Babu Salam, and we exit, this was the location, and we located it and we found it. We went into this particular house after excavating it. We found all the ghurfa, all the rooms intact. As a matter of fact, we even found the ghurfatul wahi, where the revelation came by Jibreel alayhi salam, mm-hmm. to that location. We even found where Umm al-Mu'mineen gave birth, to the very location, to Fatima alayhi radiallahu anha. The point here is, we wanted to preserve this, and we asked them that we will preserve it and keep it intact, so pilgrim and bring a glass layer over it, so people can come and see where the Prophet ﷺ lived, yes. in a very simple, modest life. They said, no, we cannot allow that. And then eventually we realized we have to do something, so re-excavate it after a couple of years, when we have the chance. Anyway, we came an idea. We compacted it with clean white sand so that it's not disturbed, and then slabbed it over with marbles. The following year, we realized they came and built 1,400 bathrooms and toilets over that very house, Bayt al-Khadija. And that house is leaking today with sewage, because the amount of machinery they put up, which are very, very catapulted machinery to dig up and excavate, that is fractured that particular location, okay? Number two, I'm going to shock the listeners here, Muslims and non-Muslims. In 1996, there was no Kaaba. The Kaaba was removed brick by brick. All the people were doing is circumambulating, some whiteboards in the shape of the Kaaba. And I have many witnesses who have seen this and have gone inside, who were privileged to go inside and pray the two rakatain. The Hajar Aswad was bought out. And the reason why is because the columns, three columns, they said that the bricks of the Kaaba had deteriorated and were causing dampness. There was some insects which were eating the cockroaches, the columns, wooden columns. So therefore, it had to be rebuilt. And the bricks had gone back, let's say, about 350 years ago. So they weren't as close as the prophetic periods, but certainly historical. Yeah. And we found idols in the basement. We found coins, we found idols from that particular period. That could have been preserved in the museums. But what they did, they took all the bricks, they took whatever you found, and they put them in the black bags, and they made them sink at the port of Jeddah at the Red Sea. The reason being, people will not take the bricks as relics of the Kaaba. So the Kaaba has been, you cannot rebuild the Kaaba, because the Kaaba has always been rebuilt by the prophets. You can maintain it, you can look after it, but not demolish it and rebuild it, because it's been built 8 times over history. But this is what Saud has done. Let's talk about the house of Hamza. I used to warn the Muslims that the house of Sayyidina Hamza is on the Shara Ibrahim Khalil Street. It's part of a mosque. Let's protect it before it is razed. And no one believed me. What happened 10 years ago, the house of Sayyidina Hamza does not exist. It's all gone. Even the mosque is taken down. It's all disappeared. So what are we waiting for? Are we waiting for the disappearance of Zamzam, which is very close to be disappeared because of this ugly dynamite which are being penetrated every day, to continue building 127 skyscrapers? What we see now is only 10% of what's to come. 10%. And if you're shocked now, imagine what is going to happen the next few years coming down. And Medina is to follow, by the way, because they've already released a plan to build towering skyscrapers overlooking Al-Baqi from the top side. So what are we going to do? Are we going to allow them to continue doing this?
Okay, doctor. So let's talk about Hejaz. Let's talk about the Hejazis themselves. Because for those who are not familiar with the history, that we have basically the Al Saud having various periods of rule on the Arabian Peninsula, the latest being what's called the Third Saudi State. And basically, the country which is called Saudi Arabia with this name is established in 1932 when the Najdi Saudis are able to conquer Hejaz and to annex Hejaz. So let's talk a little bit about Hejaz itself and how, because for people who are not familiar, they assume it's just all one thing and one people and one country. So if you could please give us a little bit insight into the culture, identity, and history of Hejaz itself, which is separate from the Al Saud.
Well, you see, if we go back before the House of Saud took over Al Hejaz, the Ottomans ruled this in a very intact way. Everything was preserved by the Ottomans. The Al-Baqi was preserved, and we have images on the screen there. And the big dome, Sayyidah Fatima, amongst the Hassan and Zain al-Abidin, Muhammad al-Baqir, Jafar al-Sadiq. So these were all intact. People used to go and visit al-Baqi, al-Mu'alla, and all the locations, and have blessed water from the wells of the Prophet's family and the Ahlul Bayt. But the Bedouins, as the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam said, that there will be camel herders and naked Bedouins who will take over Najd, and this is Riyadh, as we know, by the way. Although they claim this is not Riyadh, this is some part of Iraq and Iran, this is absolutely fabricated lie, because Najd is very clearly mentioned by the Prophet as being Riyadh. And when now Al Saud conquers Al Hijaz, as we know it, the first thing that they do is wipe away not the Ottoman heritage. So let's be clear, not the Osmani heritage, not the Abbasi heritage, although the Abbasids have been there as well, but they wipe away the prophetic heritage. They wipe away the heritage which belongs to Islam and the Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam. And why? Is because they have been penetrated by the evil machinery that the Tawheed is the only route to Allah. And you cannot have an intermediary. You cannot have You cannot have Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, even though he's the messenger, he's Habibullah. You cannot have the Ahlul Bayt of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, even though Allah says, O Prophet, your household has been purified. They do not believe in any of this. They said it's only the Quran and the Tawheed. Even the Hadith is fabricated. They consider themselves to be the humblites of the followers of Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal. But come on, Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, I can give you many quotes that he believed in what we believe in rather than them. So them to be able to come over Hijaz, which was a land of purification, which was land of the Silk Trail, where people would come from the from China, from the subcontinent, trade from different faiths outside the holy cities. And then you have the frankincense coming in, and as we said, the Silk Route, where people will meet and trade and show interest. And then you got to remember when this sacred land eventually is taken over Saudi Arabia, they realize this is an opportunity to make money and to be able to live on this surplus wealth. And this is only gifted to them by the Prophet, the Uhud is gold itself. So it's not only black gold or oil that they're living on, but they've got gold. And hence, they don't have any fear. Plus, the extortionate funds they're charging for Hajj and Umrah.
Exactly.
So what happened now? They have started allowing this to build up and accumulate a lot of wealth for the House of Saud, and recently allowed non-Muslims, and I'm talking seriously here, non-Muslims who are Yahudis, who are Christians, who are atheists, to be able to enter Makkah al-Mukarramah, Masjid al-Haram, and Masjid al-Nabawi Sharif to be able to see what we do there.
We have to clarify, Dr. Alawi, that this is strictly forbidden in Islamic law, in all Islamic schools, that this is something unprecedented in the history of Islam, that there has never been any Islamic school of thought that has allowed this, and yet they are doing this. I just wanted to clarify that.
Absolutely. Makkah al-Mukarramah, Medina al-Munawwara is forbidden for non-Muslims to enter. It's mentioned in the Quran. This is the holy sacred sanctuary. And this has been happening quite recently. They've actually done selfies in Masjid al-Nabawi Sharif, in Makkah al-Mukarramah. But the point is, this was to come. And the Muslims should have had a wake-up call. When you have Hardee's, when you have McDonald's,
exactly,
which have been there flourishing for several years, did they really think they will not allow the non-Muslims to come over there? I mean, Paris Hilton, for God's sake, you know, she opened the Hilton complex, the lavish style hotels there.
Did she bring her dog? Actually,
yes, yes. Now, she wanted to open there,
yes.
Launch the hotel. Yes. These are the puppets of the West, of the Zionist regime. The point here is, this is pure land. And let me make myself clear here. The holy sanctuary is not only located around the Kaaba. Mm-hmm. I have a map which shows the boundaries of the Haram, which goes vast past the boundaries that we have to Masjid Aisha or Miqat. As a matter of fact, some of the historians have said the whole sanctuary goes all the way to Jeddah. All the way to Jeddah. You're not able to enter because, don't forget, Makbara al-Hawa, where the first female created by Allah, Eve, is buried, and even that grave is demolished. So let's not just say, oh, well, Makkah is the only sacred precincts. Right. No, it goes all the way from Jeddah all the way to Medina al-Manawra, except Najd, which is Riyadh.
Okay, doctor, so we've come to the end, but I want to end in a little bit of a hopeful note. Maybe we can look into the future. Maybe one day, if the Ahl-e Saud are no longer ruling there, do we have the documents, the maps, the drawings, maybe even older pictures of how it was, how Mecca, Medina, and the areas that you were describing, how they are, so that maybe one day we can reconstruct and rebuild this heritage the way it was originally, in its original form? Is this possible?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, in my collection, in our library of the Islamic heritage, we have 45,000 images. Some of the images have never been accessed
Very
by
good.
The public.
Very good.
We have the Ottoman, the rulers who actually sanctioned professional photographers to be able to take photographs of the Masjid al-Nabawi and the Haram Sharif.
Very interesting.
Sacred albums by them. But let's talk about the realistic idea to bring back this lost heritage. Mm-hmm. We have engineers from Egypt, we have engineers from Iraq, Iran, we have scientists, we have blueprints of these locations, we have maps where, for example, well, the wells were, and then they were taken away and concreted. We can rebuild Mecca. As a matter of fact, we can rebuild Mecca even in a 3D model in any
Correct.
Country we like. That's how sophisticated it is. And what we have been doing now, just for our viewers, is we've made a navigation system, which is mm-hmm. called the Hijra route. And one can load it onto their mobile, although it's not immediately available. And you can actually follow the Hijra route from Mecca all the way to Medina Munawwara, where he settled, where he prayed, where he sat. And so what we want is people to follow that seerah of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, from his birthplace to Amina and always passing away to Medina. And yes, we have the Rawda Sharif or the Hujra Sharifa of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasalam from inside. Again, which I should remind our leaders, the Green Dome is under threat. I'm not saying that it's going to be threatened by the demolition of the Green Dome, which they want to demolish anyway.
Yes, we have it also here on the screen here.
Yes. When I went inside the Hujra Sharifa, the columns inside are deteriorating. Mm-hmm. The house of Fatima is allocated next to the house of Aisha, as you know.
Correct.
The columns are deteriorating. They are not maintaining them. And if you look at a professional machine and scale on the model of the Green Dome, it is slanting down. It's not on the level.
Correct.
Because it's very, very old. It's ancient. And they want it to collapse. They want it. They will not allow us to maintain the Hujra Sharifa from inside. We're not saying to touch or disturb the graves. Those are enclosed with the wall. But we want to maintain the house of Fatima and the enclosure inside, which is in a derelict state. So we have everything of that, how it was prior to the Ottoman age. But we can do it. But we need the support of the Muslim and the non-Muslim world to be able to do that.
Okay, Dr. Irfan Al-Alawi, thank you so much for joining us on Inside. Inshallah, in the future, we can continue this discussion and move towards one day reconstructing the real Islamic heritage that existed in Hijaz. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Al-Alawi? Despite the ongoing destruction of Islam's holiest sites at the hands of the ignorant Wahhabi Saudi regime, there are those in the Muslim world trying to save this holy heritage, Sunni and Shia, both cooperating as brothers for this noble goal. It's a compound problem in that, first, there is massive ignorance about this ongoing crime, and second, when the facts are known, there is a sense of powerlessness to stop it, given the Saudi regime's influence and power. Muslim individuals fear that they will not receive visas for the Hajj pilgrimage if they speak out against this destruction. And governments in Muslim countries fear that the supply of Saudi petrodollars will be cut off. It is here where we have to ask ourselves, what would we answer God and His Prophet, peace be upon him, in the next world when asked why we remain silent as we witnessed the destruction of this holy heritage? Right in the era of human history when the Ottoman Caliphate, which served as a guardian of Holy Hijaz, is destroyed, and the British, Americans, and Zionists begin to conquer the Muslim heartland centuries after the Crusades, right in this era we see that the most ignorant and violent Bedouin tribes of Arabia are given royal titles, petrodollars, and weapons, with which they set out to literally destroy the physical history of Islam. Who benefits from this destruction? Who benefits when Muslims are forever separated from the physical history of their religion and Prophet and his holy family and righteous companions? How is it that the most fundamental affairs of the Muslim Ummah are given over to the most ignorant tribes, and the two holiest cities of Islam are turned into third-rate imitations of the West's worst architectural filth? We pray for the liberation of Holy Hijaz from the occupation of the ignorant tribes, and God willing, the reconstruction of the religious heritage of Islam by the hands and sincere hearts of all devoted Muslims from every corner of the Muslim Ummah. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English.